Cabbage night. How many of you have big plans for cabbage night? Some of you are from away. How many of you celebrate cabbage night? Explain.
It's called
mischief night.
Mischief night,
yeah. Yep. Halloween night is for candy. Cabbage night is the night before, and it's for mischief. So, where I grew up, it was shelled corn on the porch against the plate glass windows. It makes a wonderful sound at midnight. Burning tires in the middle of the road, that was always good. Hay bales, they were good. And of course, there's always the threatened outhouse tipping. But you don't know about outhouses, but anyway. Those of us who grew up with outhouses, the cabbage night was the night to wait till somebody got in it and then tip it forward on the door. Only one way out. Well-built outhouses had escape hatches. Okay, enough of that. I should erase that on the iPod. Okay. Yes.
What does not being able to serve lead to a child's performance or behavior?
Okay. What would not being able to conserve do to a child, as what kind of behavior would you see? And that requires that you have some idea of what conservation is. And what realm are we in? Who are we talking about?
Children.
Yeah. Do you connect the notion of conservation to anybody in the text? Piaget. Okay. Yes. And what does it mean to conserve something? Okay, understanding that some characteristics of the object don't change even though other characteristics do. And so what it means is that certain characteristics are preserved across transformation. Okay, and that's what Piaget said. What he did was, and a couple of these are sort of classics described in the text. One is you take two balls of clay, same size, present them to the child as spheres, ask the child to indicate whether or not they're the same size. Is this, they're the same amount of clay in each? And the kid adjusts and okay. Yes. The kid agrees that they're the same. And then you take one of them and you flatten it into a pancake. Then the question is, do they still have the same amount of clay? And if you're 4 years old, you're likely to say, okay, now you're dealing with this sphere and this pancake, Do they have the same amount of play? What do you say first before we get to the four-year-old? They had the same amount. You flattened one of them. Do they still have the same amount of play? Yes. Okay. You're all sure about that? Okay. In other words, you think the amount was conserved across the transformation in shape. Okay. Is that always the case? Okay. How do you know? Why are you convinced that there's the same amount of clay? Okay, you started out with the same amount of clay, and I didn't remove or add any. So the way you change the amount of clay is to remove some or add some. All I did was change the shape, and if I am convinced that the amount is independent of shape, then I will tell you that there's the same amount. And if I say why to the child will say, because you didn't add any or take any away, you just changed its appearance. And that will be an indication that the child has begun to develop the mental operations that Piaget calls concrete, because they're performed on real things, like balls of clay. The four-year-old is likely to tell me that the pancake has more clay because it's bigger. And by that, he means it's wider, because I squished it down. If the kid is sitting way down at the table, looking at it from the side, some kids will say this one has more because this one is lower. It's flatter. Or the kid is not conserving, they say this one has more because it's wider, even though it's lower. So what the child who's not conserving is doing is being fooled by the appearances, because she hasn't quite consolidated the meaning of amount and hasn't figured out that if I don't add anything and I don't take anything away, I haven't changed the amount, because that's what amount means, how much there is. And if they're equal when they look the same, they still have the same amount after I change the shape. Okay. Let me give you another example and then go to the question that was actually asked. Another one of Piaget's famous was two beakers, or two glasses, same shape, same size, and you put the same amount in them. You ask the child, do they have the same? Some kids will get down and look at it and they'll add till they're exactly the same. Put it back. Yes, okay, convinced. Then you take one of them and pour it into a tall, thin glass. And when you do that, what's going to happen? Is it going to be the same height as it was before? No. It's going to be higher. You said this one was equal. Now do they have the same amount? Again, the 3 or 4 year old says, no, this one has more. The tall one has more because it's taller. Some 3 or 4 year olds will say, the original one has more because it's wider. After you've developed the notion, this is the clay is conservation of the amount, the solid amount. the liquid gives you conservation of the liquid quantity. And so it's more changeable. After a kid has figured out that the amount doesn't change just because you change the shape, then when you say, well, how do you know that? And the child will say, well, if you pour the tall, thin one back into the original, it'll be the same. Then you get some really smart kids. We had a fun time many, many years ago. Dale Goldhaber and I videotaped our children and a couple of other kids doing the Piaget test. And my daughter was 6 and pretty well into concrete operations, and my son was not quite 4. And he didn't have it yet. So we were doing them one at a time, but when we got to my son, Gwen was helping the examiner. And so he said, classically, when you pour it into the tall, thin one, there's more in that one. And Gwen very helpfully said, he says that because it looks like it's taller, but it's also thinner, narrower. What she was doing was explaining to him that his perception was distracting him, that the change in height is compensated for by the decrease in width. So what happens as part of developing the notion of conservation is that you come to understand that a change in one dimension is matched by a change in the other dimension, and they essentially cancel each other out. But the child who's not yet concrete operational is centered on one dimension. And so in Piaget says the kid is centered, and development is partly a process of decentering. It means that the child is going to be able to look at both changes, the increase in height and the decrease in width, at the same time, and come to understand that those cancel each other out. But they make it appear either taller or narrower, but that's irrelevant. And one of the ways you know that it hasn't changed is that you know that a change in one dimension is canceled out or matched by, compensated for by a change in the other dimension. Once you become concrete operational and you get that, and you just, well, it's the same amount because you didn't take any away, and you can reverse it. So the concrete operations lead you to be able to put something back the way it was to demonstrate that it really hasn't changed. So the notion of reversibility of operations is fundamental to the notion of conservation, and conservation is the belief, the understanding that the amount doesn't change even if you change the shape, either the shape of the lump of clay, the shape of the container the liquid's in, doesn't matter. You can also do it with line of pennies. You've got 5 pennies, and you've got 5 more pennies arranged in the same way. And then if you take one of them and spread it out and change its shape, a 3-year-old is likely to say there are more pennies in the longer line, even though you haven't changed the actual number. Once kids learn to count, then they can conserve the number no matter where you put the pennies. You started with 5, you've still got 5, it doesn't matter where you put them, you're still able to count them, and it still gets to 5. The fun thing is watching a kid who doesn't conserve. The 3-year-old or 4-year-old will tell you that they're the same amount of pennies when you've got 2 rows of 5, but if you put them in a spread out squiggly line, he'll say there are more, and prove that to you by counting. It's one of those wonderful demonstrations that Piaget saw, kids defending their belief, even though their belief is wrong. So what they do is they count one, two, three, four, five, but they know there's more in the other line now. So they'll count. One, two, three, four, five, six. They just lose the one-to-one correspondence between the numbers. And they're okay, I got six, so there are more in that line. Okay? What happened? What do kids do because they don't conserve? And any examples from your own childhood? Battles with younger siblings? Teaching experiences? They'll give you reasons why it's their way. They'll also, in many cases, be fooled by appearances. They'll be fooled by appearances. So if you have a piece of cake, okay, this is birthday party stuff, right? You got a piece of cake, and the hostess has very carefully cut the cakes, the pieces, into identical size cake pieces. And you've got two kids who don't conserve. So you've got one kid has a piece of cake. The other kid takes the same piece of cake and cuts it into four smaller pieces. The kid with the original piece of cake who didn't cut hers now is pissed because the other kid got more cake. Even though at the beginning it was the same size. And you can ask the kid, do you have the same? The kid will say yes. Then you take one and cut it into four pieces, and the kid is convinced that the kid with four pieces has more cake. But failure to conserve the solid quantity of cake, because it's now in four pieces. So the three-year-old starts screaming for more cake because the other one's bigger. Or some of you were the big sister, right? And you had a younger sibling. How many of you learned to torment? How did you do it? Any specific ways you did it? My daughter again, my poor son, I don't know how he grew up even partway normal. She just learned all these things. She just got them. She would, two pieces of toast, didn't matter what it was, a box of chocolates at Christmas. And they would be the same, because we did that. She would wait until her little brother had eaten one of his pieces of chocolate, or two, or took a big bite of his toast, and then she would point out to him that she got a bigger piece. She had more. And he would freak out, because he couldn't conserve the amount through the transformation of eating some. It meant that she had more, and she could do it. She did it over and over and over again, until we wised up and started punishing her. Okay. Now, it's a little bit different than Piaget's, because he's not just responding to the change in appearance. He's actually eaten a piece. But once he's eaten it, then his looks different, and it doesn't matter that he's eaten it. He's enjoyed it. He wants to have eaten his cake and have it too. By the time he was six or seven, that stuff didn't work anymore. He'd just look at her and say, yeah, I ate a piece. Duh, I've already started enjoying it. So he was not able to be annoyed by her. If this were an essay question, Let's see. How would I ask an essay? Well, generally, I'm looking for. Sometimes it's given example, so I'm looking for an example that's appropriate to the concept, and then an explanation of that that makes it really clear that you understand the concept that you're illustrating with the example. If it's a describe the relationship between, then I'm looking for as elaborate a description as you can give of how two things are related to each other. And relationships are typically, in this course, you know, bidirectional, transactional. So just the problem with essay answers, typically the biggest problem is not giving enough explanation so that a naive reader can tell that you really understand the question and the concepts that are included in it. So it's going. The usual advice I give is, assuming that you know the material, write it and then go on to something else and come back and reread it and figure out how you could make it clearer.
What's the difference between concrete and formal
operations? Okay. The concrete operations, what's the difference between the concrete and the formal? Okay, when we're talking about kids who can serve and who have concrete operational logic, they're in middle childhood. They're the elementary school kids. And when you start to move into being able to use the formal operations, that typically happens around puberty. So you're becoming an adolescent as that's happening. So once you get into middle adolescence, you're generally able to use the formal operations reasonably well. Not in every area, but you have learn to apply logic to abstract ideas. And remember, the formal operations are called formal because they're about the form of things, the pattern, the abstract patterns, the relationships, rather than about the things themselves. Concrete operations are about the characteristics of things. And the formal operations are about patterns. So being able to do the verbal analogies that we demonstrated, being able to deal with two systems of reference at the same time, being able to recognize the similarity and dissimilarities between the pattern that was in the chemical combinations problem and then the Planned Parenthood ménage à trois situation, being able to see that the content of those is quite different, but the pattern of relationships was the same. It requires the formal operations, the mental operations that let you do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the concrete operations, he called them concrete because they deal with the reality that kids are dealing with. They apply to the logic of numbers. I erased the coins, but the relationships of transformations of clay. When clay is real, it's there. The liquid. It's the concrete operations mean that the child is able to think logically about the experiences that he can see or she can see. And they're based on doing actions with those materials. So when you're watching kids develop those mental operations, they play with things and they transform them, and then they reverse that transformation. That's why you give kids manipulables. That's why you give them clay to play with, why you let them play in a sand table and water table. You give them buckets and measuring cups so that they can engage in actions that are about transforming things. And Piaget said you can't develop logic without being able to act on materials and make sense of the actions that you're performing. And so it's a sensory motor activity, but it's looking at the properties of the things that you're playing with. Okay. Organizing things, putting them into categories, shape boxes, discovering the relationship between a shape and the hole that it fits in. Okay. All of those actions lead the child to be able to think logically by the time the kid is 5 or 6 about how things are related to each other based on those actions. But when you get to the chemical problem or the verbal analogies, you can't manipulate that with your hands. You can't create a verbal analogy and make it happen and unhappen. It's a mental operation that you have to do. You have to be able to think about how the bicycle and the bell are related to each other and how that's similar to the car and the horn. You have to have the experience with the horn and the car and all that, and that's sensory motor and pre-operational. But to see that the analogy works requires that you do mental operations that you can't actually do. You don't have the horn and the car. You don't have the bell and the bicycle. You have to put them together in your mind and create a form into which both examples fit. And what you're doing is using those particular mental operations to create that general form. And then you can apply that form mentally. You know, what is the auditory warning device on a fire engine, on a steamboat, on a locomotive, on an 18-wheeler? You're applying that same form over and over again. That process of applying it is a formal mental operation. Mm-hmm. Nobody said understanding intellectual development is easy. It's extremely challenging. The first few times you look at the examples and try to figure out how they connect to each other. What are these stages really about? And all I hope you get is what can you do. What do kids do differently in those 4 stages? And what do the problems that we've gone over demonstrate? How do they demonstrate that? What's the relationship between work and intellectual development? What kind of work am I talking about? Generally, I would be thinking about employment, the kind of job you do. But I wouldn't want to restrict it to that, because some people do very difficult work, very complex work, without getting paid for it. And the question is one that's addressed in the text. Looking at people who continue to develop intellectually through adulthood and people whose development kind of stops. And the generalization about it is that you're constantly you're constantly trying to make sense of the experience you have. And if your experience continually challenges you and requires you to accommodate novel experiences, and you're constantly having to extend your thinking, then you're going to continue to develop intellectually. And the generalization that they provide in the text is that people who are engaged in complex work, work that requires reorganizing your thinking, learning new things, solving problems that you've never seen before, people who have that kind of work are likely to continue their intellectual development. And they're also going to maintain their intellectual skills longer than other people, as long as they continue to engage in complex activities. So even after retirement, you see people volunteering, learning new things, learning new skills, and that's the key to maintaining your brain. You probably know people who haven't had to learn anything new in their job for 30 years. Now maybe you don't. I do. I know people who've done essentially the same thing. There may be a new menu, but you know, they learn it, but it's nothing new. You serve the food to the people who come in, you take the money, you run the cash register, and you don't do anything that requires any more intellectual skill than that. And if you give people who are in essentially dead-end jobs, they may be quite happy at the job, but it doesn't require any new intellectual stuff. If you watch their intellectual development across adulthood, it's likely to be flat or declining. It's likely to decline faster, and they're more likely to, unfortunately, they're more likely to show signs of dementia or senility or Alzheimer's earlier than people who do more complex work. So there's a pretty direct relationship between using your brain and challenging your brain and maintaining your intellectual skills. And on the other side of that curve, not using it, not learning anything new, not being challenged, leads that set of intellectual skills to decline as well. So it's use it or lose it, both physically and intellectually. Robert Sternberg. There's an overhead on the website. I usually don't remember when asked. Sternberg is one of the major thinkers. He's a professor at Yale. He's one of our major thinkers about intellectual development. He's done a lifetime worth of research on it. But the part that's described in the text and the one I showed the overhead for is that he says that our actual use of our intellect, particularly to solve problems, to learn new things, to do a job, is really not a single skill, but there are sort of three components to it. And one of those is the critical, kind of analytic, break things down systematically skill that we admire in people who really do a lot of math or a lot of logical stuff. They come into a task and they can break it down into its components. I think he calls that the componential, some word like that. And then there's another aspect of intelligence which he doesn't call intuitive. It's I did on the overhead indicate that it's that aspect of intelligence that's creative, figuring out how things work without really knowing how you know it, but being able to look at a problem and jump to something new, put things together in an unusual way. He doesn't call it the creative, but I do. And what he says is that at different times or in different areas, we may use one or the other. And different people have more skill or more preference for one or the other. So the engineering majors are rewarded for being analytic and systematic about taking things apart. They don't get a lot of points for intuition. I mean, you can use intuition, but you've got to be able to back it up with the math. And then the third piece for him is the practical, or some words like that. And what he means is that there are people who are really good at figuring out how things work, how to do things, and they also can look at, I think he calls it the contextual. Correct me if I'm wrong, but... And by that he means that there are people who can look at the context and figure out what's really important and how to do the job. And he suggests that we all have all three, that anytime you're working on problems or trying to do work, trying to solve a problem or understand something, you use all three, but we use them to different degrees. And some situations reward one more than the other. We may use one part for one part of a problem and then move to another part. But he wants us to understand that there are three different ways or different aspects to thinking. And you can measure them, but you can also see them in real situations. So he might, let me give you an example. Sternberg might say, let me give you a personal example. I often create possible tasks for myself, and they almost always come from the intuitive, the creative mind. So I may say, gee, that's sort of like something else that I've done. I'll see a connection. And I will think, you know, we really need to have a book that does X, Y, or Z. You could really put together something. That's the creative piece. Then I will apply the practical or contextual after I get over the rosy glow of thinking I could get rich by writing this book. The rosy glow fades and I get to the practical part, which is, it's probably going to take me a long time to do that, and I really don't have time to do it. I really should have been an acquisitions editor for a publisher, because then I could have the idea and then go out and get somebody else to write it. The practical part of me says that you can't write three books at the same time and have a life. You can't even write one book at the same time and have a life. Discovered that. And then the analytic part, the critical part, will say, okay, if I were going to do this, this is what I would need to do. And then you figure out the steps. Yeah. So this happened Thursday morning. It's a wonderful morning. I came into the office. I'd had an idea in the shower. It stayed with me. That's the creative part. I got to the office and I sat down and outlined, it's about 30 minutes, I outlined an article that I really would like to write. And it fell into place, but it's very logical, I think, the outline. I should go back and read it. Maybe it's not. But it seemed to me at the time to be quite logical, and I started to make some notes about what I would need to read first and what I would need. So that's the analytic. Okay, this is how to get this done. And then the practical part kicks in. It says, okay, when are you going to do this? You can do this next July. If we put it on the calendar, you know, we're going to do it next July. Well, maybe August. But it's not going to get done before then. Other times, the practical part will kick in and say, that's a really neat thing you could do. Yes, you could do that. There's no way in heck you are actually going to do that. So don't invest any more time and energy in that. I have a friend who demonstrates all three of those. He happens to want the perfect house, and he has some really wonderful creative ideas. And every couple of years, he spends 3 or 4 days, usually when he's avoiding real work, he spends 3 or 4 days designing an incredibly wonderful house. And he's really good at he'll get an idea. Okay, I'm going to build a house a particular sort, and they're always different. He's designed, I guess, 5, 6. And then he does the sketches, and he figures out how big they're going to be and all of that. And then his wife says, because he insists that when he builds the dream house, he will do it himself. And then she brings in the practical contextual part, which says you can't afford it. It's not going to happen. So, work involves each of those three components, Sternberg says, to different degrees. Some jobs require the analytic. Some jobs require the intuitive. Some jobs require the practical. And some jobs require a mix of them. Part of the key, Sternberg is also interested in happiness. He says one of the keys to being happy in life is having a job that lets you use the skills that are most compatible and comfortable for you. Okay, what is constructivism? The constructivist view of anything has 2 or 3 specific features. I say 2 or 3 because I'm not sure how many I'm going to remember and push. We'll know when we get there. Constructivist views assume that intellectual development is a process that happens in the person. It's an active process. It's the process of making sense out of your experience. And a constructivist view suggests that things start off really simple. In the case of Piaget, intellectual development starts with reflexes and actions in infancy, and then you develop memories of those specific actions, schemas, and then you construct figure schemas by differentiating your experience and by integrating schemas into more complex schemas. So you eventually figure out how things are connected to each other. And your understanding becomes more complex as it gets more highly differentiated. But you construct the relationships, you construct your understanding of the schemas, you construct your ability to apply those schemas the new situations. part of the parallel to biological development here is that in motor development, I didn't really call it a constructivist view, but what the child is constructing is a set of skills, of motor skills, and starts with reflexes, and then actions become more complex, and you are able to combine your actions into more complex movement. So you start with ballet, figuring out how to stand up, and then how to control your feet one at a time, and then how to shift your weight. And you keep adding new movements until eventually you can string them together in an infinite variety of dances at different tempos to different kinds of music, with or without partners. So the constructivist approach says that the process is an active one based on your own action and making sense out of your own actions yourself. That you can't give somebody knowledge. You can provide experience, but they will interpret that experience in their own way. Yes, the question is to elaborate on the connections between biological development and cognitive development, and is it more than just creating synapses and connections? And fundamentally, intellectual development is always based on creating memory traces and processing information in a brain that's supporting that. But beyond that, you think about the fact that as the brain goes through major changes, such as puberty or the integrations that happen at 5 to 7 years of age, the processing leads to more complex cognitive skills. You could also connect it by pointing out that the brain development generally is paralleled by intellectual development, assuming that experience is being had, and that as the brain experiences insults or begins to fall apart, intellectual development is affected by that, usually negatively. So a stroke, a tumor, lack of oxygen, all of those damage the brain, and to the extent that the brain is damaged, intellectual functioning is compromised. So you're really basing it on the status of the brain. And as the brain deteriorates during senility, during senescence, in old age, if that's when it happens, then intellectual skills are also declining. The terminal drop that I mentioned in the last lecture, the decline in IQ scores, is an example of the connection, because as the brain is experiencing whatever declines it's experiencing, test scores, intellectual functioning is declining. And you see the decline in the test scores even before you may be aware that there's something actually going wrong in the brain. We don't usually test old people regularly, but if you're with somebody regularly, you can see declines in intellectual performance, and those should always lead to a physical exam and find out what's going on, because those intellectual changes may not be necessary. Intellectual decline is not a necessary part of old age. Intellectual decline happens when there's something going wrong in the brain. So if you're not getting enough oxygen in your brain, you're going to see your ability to do crossword puzzles decline. I use crossword puzzles because that's the indicator I follow almost every day with my mother, who does crossword puzzles and ink. And as long as she can still come up with the names of four-letter flightless extinct birds and African deer-like mammals, words I don't know, she has to fill those in the crossword. She has that vocabulary. As long as she keeps that vocabulary, I don't worry about her much. As long as she's looking out the window and wondering where each person is going and watching when they come back and telling me all the news of the day where she lives, we're okay. But when I see her stop being interested in what people are doing, or if she stops being interested in the newspaper, then I'm going to be worrying about what's going on in her brain. I'm going to get her to the doctor. But typically, you know, if she's sick, she's not intellectually as sharp, but then she comes back. The increases are during the developmental years. They're based on, as Piaget said, maturation of the brain is one of the factors involved in the child's development, but experience is also part of that. The increases as you use your brain, as you use your mind and do more complex things, you're creating those synaptic connections, you're creating those circuits in the brain, and you're at the same time probably keeping the brain healthy. There's a little less evidence for that. I'm trying to think if there are other connections between increases in intellectual development and biology. Yeah, after adolescence, probably none that I can think of.
Could you say that as you develop biologically, you have more interaction with more experiences?
Yes, certainly you can talk about for example, the increases in motor skills, giving you the opportunity to have more experiences, and that's clearly important for children, that they're able to have experiences to make sense out of. You could also make that argument for the challenges that puberty brings. As your body changes, you got to make sense out of that. And you got to make sense out of the fact that people are treating you differently. So you're challenged then. And some people would argue that the development of formal operational thinking is in part the response to the changes of puberty, not because the brain is changing, although I would put my money there. The brain is becoming more complex at puberty. But some people would add to that the notion that puberty is making you think harder because it's giving you more challenges. Now, when people start hitting on you because you've gone through puberty, because people change their expectations of you because you look more adult, they're giving you more challenges, and you've got to make sense, you've got to construct meaning out of those. So you could argue that that biological change leads you to become more intellectually skilled. Anna Freud had that position. She said that we become abstract thinkers in adolescence in order to deal with the biological changes of puberty and their impact. That won't be on the exam.
What's the difference between integration of flyleaf to language? How does that
work? We didn't really talk about language, so I won't ask that question this time. I have in the past. I might ask it about cognitive development, but I won't ask it specifically about language because I haven't talked about language. I will next Wednesday. But in intellectual development, the example I just gave of in defining a constructivist view relies on a constructivist view relies on differentiating experience and patterns and being able to integrate them into more complex patterns. One of the examples I did give in language, but I won't ask the question, is the example of it's raining because I brought my umbrella. And the child who says that hasn't differentiated the meaning of because and hasn't differentiated cause and effect into it's two different, there are two different directions. So it's raining because I brought my umbrella does not mean the same thing as it's raining so I brought my umbrella. So and because have to be differentiated. They're both causal words, but they're opposites. And the child has to differentiate them to understand that. In one case, the effect is because of the cause, and in the other case, the cause creates the effect. Just it depends on whether you start with the cause or the effect in the sentence, whether you use because or so. But you can't use them interchangeably. But I won't ask that one. There are sex differences in cognitive development if the text says there are. I haven't talked about them at all. Gilligan and Colbert. There are some sex differences cognitively, but the text doesn't talk about the ones that I'm aware of. There's a lot of relatively new research on, particularly on the relationship of the use of different parts of the brain. Men and women use different parts of the brain to attack the same problem, and that probably leads them to deal with problems differently, but the text refers to very, very little of that research. You're not going to stay out late tonight, right? Okay. Get a good night's sleep. Eat lunch before the exam. Meditate, take a nap after lunch before the exam. Why are you shaking your heads? And it is okay if you come in costume. Some of you I know are going immediately from the exam to parties. Halloween, or you're going trick-or-treating, it's okay to come in costume. See you tomorrow.